It's the 24th of February today, and I'm going to the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh to do an interview with Andy Warhol's brother, John Warhola. Waiting for John Warhola. It feels quite strange. The gallery is closed. I'm standing in front of a huge portrait of Andy, a screen print. It's a self-portrait done in 1986, a silk screen. And Andy said, "When I did my self-portrait, I left all the pimples out. Pimples are a temporary condition, and they don't have anything to do with what you really look like. Always admit the blemishes. They're not part of a good picture you want." It seems quite strange to be meeting Andy's brother. I so much I want to ask him, but I don't want to trespass. I want to know what it feels like to have such a famous brother, to have a whole museum dedicated to the works of your brother. I want to know about his childhood. I want to know how much Andy talked. I want to know about his voice. I want to know how he played. I want to know about their mother. How do you ask these questions? It's quite difficult. It's been a strange week. A very strange week. Listening endlessly to tapes of parties. People drinking, people eating, people talking, people gossiping. And in the entrance to the museum where I am at the moment, waiting, there are the portraits of all those people, all those voices. It seems so strange that he painted these very flat works, and yet the tapes are the opposite of flat. I was just talking to myself, walking around the portrait, saying there's a certain irony that here I am with a tape recorder and I've been listening all week to Andy's tapes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm doing a doctorate based around an archive that they have here, which no one's really investigated before. And it's the tape archive, and it's all the tapes that he made of conversations, tapes he made for the philosophy book. And I've picked out certain ones that I'm looking at in greater depth. I mean, some of them are inaudible and they're just a multiplicity of voices that are driving me crazy, but other ones are really interesting. What I'd really like to chat about, firstly, one kind of missing link for me is, although there's a huge amount written about Andy and his growing up, I'm just fascinated why he had on one side this obsession to take people. I mean, was he very silent as a child? Was he always interested in conversations? Did he listen to people's conversations as an observer? Can you recall?
Yeah, I think of it when we were growing up, we were playing ball, you know, and, you know, you'd pick up sides. I'd never seen him argue. Like, you know, two kids would always get in an argument. And I can't remember him ever getting in an argument. It just seemed like he probably felt it was a waste. I don't know, some way he just got out of it. And then later on in life where I really noticed that he could get you talking about yourself, and he just sat there and listened. And I still picture him, he'd always sit on the steps, you know, when I'd come up with my sons, he would just say something to try to get you to open up and start talking.
So you think then that really he always had a tendency more to listen and maybe to provoke people in a sense, to have them confess things, because of course good listeners, people feel they can confide in good listeners. So you think he was a good listener? In the tapes I've been listening to, he does talk quite a lot. In what situations do you recall he would talk a great deal? Were there any, I mean, at home when he was a child, maybe talking about films or something like that?
No, what I think started him on films, there was no radio or TV, and I remember him getting the first radio was just like somebody a family just getting their first TV to black and white.
When would that have been? When did you get your first radio, do you think?
That was probably 37. I would have been about 12. He'd have been about 9 years old. The whole family would sit by the radio, and you'd just listen to, you know, and you'd use your imagination, you know, where they'd have like a mystery, and you'd hear the footsteps, and you could picture this guy, a man coming through. What Andy really was fascinated by was movie stars, you know. It was hard to get, like, 10 cents to go to the movie, so it was really a treat. When we were growing up, it was the years of the Depression, you know. I don't know where all the money came from, but there was no cars. You could play out in the street because maybe a car wouldn't go by in a half hour. He was so fascinated with going to a movie, and he looked up to movie stars. And he would write to them when he was probably 9 or 10 years old. And he wrote to Shirley Temple, and she sent him a photo of her. She signed it all to Andy Warhol.
Did he show that to you?
Yeah. My mother was real easygoing. And she's the one that really encouraged him in drawing. I mean, ever since he was small. Well, all of us had to, like in the wintertime, the three boys would sit at the kitchen table, around the kitchen table. And she'd say, the one that makes the nicest drawing will get a prize, you know. Andy would always seem to win. It was a chocolate bar. A Hershey chocolate bar. It was about that big, you know. And he used to eat a little piece at a time each day. My mother was a real good artist, and she encouraged him. And she was a
what about your father? Did you show him your drawings? Was he interested in your drawings?
No, I think he worked so hard, like my wife says, you know, you should mention your dad because people a lot will think that he ran off and he didn't have a father. But he died when Andy was 13. And the kind of work he did was, if there was a road coming through here and they wanted to move his museum was in the way, they would dig all around a foundation and they could move it like about a half a block up the street. So he did that kind of work. But I remember my dad, when he'd come home, he would just, well, we bought our first house when, let's see, Andy was 6 and I was 9, and that's when we both had a garden. Andy, he grew flowers. He's very interested in flowers. And on my side, I grew the vegetables. And,
you were more practical.
Yeah. And we both won a contest, and then it was a quarter, but that was a lot of money then.
Did your mother tell you stories? Did she,
did she tell
you stories? Because one thing that I'm quite interested and fascinated by is the tapes I've been listening to of Bridget Berlin. She's really a storyteller. I mean, she does this conspiratorial voice.
Yeah.
And I just thought she realized that Andy loved to talk to her. And I wonder whether that was partly because as a child he listened to stories. I mean,
she'd tell us about Europe, you know, mostly when she was a girl. And she says, something she had that I never had. She had her own horse, but I guess it was just, it worked on a farm. It wasn't one of these expensive horses, but it was a horse that her dad made the wagon, and he took her to Midgetlabodich. That was like 6 miles away, and that was an all-day affair. And she said that was a treat for her.
And so she told you stories about
her growing up,
not right. Like fairy stories or things. It was kind of practical. It was like practical stories, but maybe they sounded very romantic or.
Yeah, and then she used to tell the kids, even my boys, when we'd spend the day, but she'd tell them stories, you know, about the boogeyman. She'd want to, you know, and they'd be real scared, you know. But I just can't think of some of the ones that, you know, that she would try to scare the kids just a little, you know, if they wouldn't behave, you know.
Now, there's also been a lot written and documented that Warhol didn't really write, that obviously his books are made from tape recordings.
Yeah.
Now, recently in the press, there's been quite a few articles that Warhol had Asperger's syndrome, or he was dyslexic, or these things that, of course, I mean, when he was growing up, wouldn't have been identified. Do you think that's true? I mean, because I understood he did rather well at school.
I don't know. When he was in grade school, the time when he had the same, they call it the same vitis dance, it was a nervous condition. He missed like a couple of months. But when he went back, he skipped the next grade. And when I graduated high school, I was almost 19. and he was 16. He graduated high school a year later, so.
We talked a little bit about the radio. Was he always fascinated by machines? I know there's been so much written, I want to be a machine, and all those kind of things. When you first got the radio, for instance, mm-hmm. was he glued to the radio? Was he fascinated by that?
Yeah, he was. He'd listen to all the stories and would... Well, when he'd be listening to the radio, doing his homework, you know, doing a drawing while he's listening to a story, and he overheard my mother talking about something with me, and he hollered and said something to her, and she said, "Andy, you're not supposed to be listening. You're supposed to be doing your homework." So he was doing three things at once. That's what I noticed about him.
That seems very much what he did do, that he was able to kind of be focusing on someone yet be completely aware of what was happening around him.
Well, especially when they interviewed Farrah Fawcett, and they said, "How come you got so personal? You told Andy Warhol all your personal troubles." She says, "Well, he was just the type of person that would listen." And I don't know why what the attraction was, but basically he was sort of shy. But people would really open up to him, and I don't know how. I was so surprised of how many famous people he met. People used to ask me, who's his best friend? I says, well, his friends were everybody, you know, all he had so many, because I know a lot of times that I went visiting him, it made me feel edgy, because when he was talking to me, and he'd have to stop and answer the phone, and he'd have to tell a person that, well, could you call me back later? My brother's here from Pittsburgh. But I told Andy, I says, well, he should have finished the conversation. I'll wait. He says, no, he says, because he says, I would never get off the phone.
And how did you feel about, obviously, when you went to New York and then he had the silver factory and everything? How aware were you at that point of what he was doing and your family? I mean, obviously, your mother was living with him, but...
He kept us away from her. His factory was away from his home, and we'd just see him like in the morning or else when he'd come home. Even like I discussed with my older brother, and he says Andy probably just, he knew that we were so different, and those students were rebelling against their family, you know, and they had financially, they had enough money to go to colleges, and they still were searching for something, and Andy probably figured that I'd probably criticize him, say that, geez, if I had what they have, they don't know what they want or something. So that was a time when there was so much going on, you know, there was all these riots, you know, with the blacks down south, and Andy would draw those pictures of you know, there's some paintings he has like that.
Yeah, the race riots.
Race riots, and like for a while, anything, like if there was a plane crash or anything, Andy would paint that picture. And he had a lot of paintings like that. He used to do all, you know, like the car wrecks, but everything changed when he was shot. He didn't draw
anymore. You went to visit him when he was shot, didn't you? You went to the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, do you think that he changed after he was shot? I mean, obviously he was always in pain after he was shot.
There was a big thing.
What was the difference, do you think?
Well, he lost weight. It took him a year to recuperate. He was, he feared people. He wouldn't even go to church where there's a crowd of people. When the services were over, he would go in.
Obviously, another thing that's been written about, really particularly since 1989, about Andy being gay, and lots of people have kind of reclaimed Andy in terms of, you know, he was a gay child and he was beaten up at school. I mean,
nobody ever beat him up anyway. and just like the one woman before the museum opened up, she asked me, you know, she said, "Was Andy gay?" I said, "No." I said, why would you ask me that?" She says, "Well, he wasn't married." I said, "Well, you know, all the Catholic priests aren't married." I said, "Would you say they're all?" She says, "You know, I never looked at it that way."
Yeah, it's like, so, he was celibate.
He was. You know, like Dennis Hopper, you know, I interviewed him, and he says, "Was Andy gay?" He says, "No." He says, "Andy was the type of person," he says, "he just loved his art," but he says...
Asexual, would you say? Celibate, asexual.
Right, yeah. And I always thought he was going to be a priest when he was young, because he would never argue about anything, and I never heard him swear, and I never seen him get angry, and I thought he'd be a priest, so
So that is really interesting, because in the factory, he very much played the role of the father confessor. I mean,
right,
people
yeah.
would come and confess They'd to come, him.
Yeah, they would. Well, the one fellow that went to Europe with Andy, on the tapes he was saying that Andy was crying because he wanted to have sex with him. Now, that wasn't true. And there's nothing I could, you know, say about it, but I remember when Andy come back, my older brother says, boy, Andy was even crying. He says that his camera broke, and the fellow that Andy borrowed his camera from, he took 10 rolls of pictures all over where they were visiting, you know, in China, and all, you know, when he went on. And he says, here the fellow wouldn't give him most tapes. So he says, Andy really, you know, he said he really cried that he went. So here on tape, this fellow, he's an engineer. I haven't forgot his name. He was saying that, oh, Andy, we had a falling out because Andy was crying because he wanted to have sex with me. And I was thinking, you know, why would you say anything so personal like that? You know.
But it's interesting because I've been listening to a lot of the audio tapes, and there isn't a single one. He'll say things like, oh, that girl is so beautiful, or he'll make comments. But there's no gay innuendo in the terms of him saying, oh, come on, come back to my room, or something to a guy. You just do not hear that. It's much more he is listening to what people are saying, and sometimes people might be flirting or something. And I think he seems to be very much, like you said, somebody who was able to observe, to be non-judgmental, which was very important, I think, for a lot of the people that he surrounded himself with. So why do you think that so much has been written? I mean, there are several books now that have been written about Andy being gay and using all kind of examples. You wouldn't imagine the examples that have been used.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
I
never seen any books, but like on film, you know, whenever I'd hear that, you know, some of the well-known curators, you know, they passed away already, and they asked him if he was gay, and he says no. He says they never. He said there was never any proof. They never know anybody that says they had any affairs with him. And
no, so that's true.
You know, so they says, why would they say that? So, well, he says some of it's jealousy, you know. And even when he was first making the movies, you know, Dennis Hopper was sort of like the rough type, you know. He gave a good answer. He says Andy was a type, he says he loved art, he loved the male and a female, but he says there was never any proof that he can't say, you know, that he had gay partners or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you very close when you were brothers? Were you closer than Paul was to Andy, do you think you were? I mean, did you kind of look out for him, look after him?
Yeah, because before my dad died, when he was ailing at home, he said, you know, people didn't go to hospital then until they were going to die, you know. And he says that he has postal bonds, and it was like, he says, I don't want you to use that money for anything but Andy's education. And he saved, I think it were something like $500 or $1,000.
Well, that was a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, because his tuition was only $200 a year then, you know. But I know he had enough to go for 2 years.
So he believed in him. He obviously knew that he had something, your dad.
My father could see.
Yes.
You know, he said he was going to go to college, and he said, you'll be proud of him someday.
Aww.
And it was just like, you know, 5 days later, my dad died. You know, he knew that. And my mother always says, you know, that's when the war was on, and Paul, he enlisted in the Navy. He'd have probably drafted him anyways, but they were going to take me too. And then a woman went up, a good friend of ours that would help my mother to clean and all that, and she just had a very serious operation, and she went up to the draft board. She says, you can't take this fellow. Mm-hmm. You know, I was only about 19 years old. She said, you can't take him to service. She says, he has a mother that's very ill at home and a younger son, and his older brother just went to the war, you know. You know,
it was a lot of responsibility for you as well.
Oh,
you became
yeah.
the head of the family.
Yeah. Well, my dad told me, he says, to watch over Andy, you know. And then when he moved to New York, I called him every Sunday for like 38 years.
Oh, wow.
And, because when they had...
What did you talk about on those phone calls? Were just what was happening
well,
with your family and what you were doing?
Yeah, sometimes it was...
Did he tape these conversations?
No, he didn't tape them. I don't think, because he didn't even paint any of our pictures. He painted... He painted Don's picture when he graduated school.
I've been listening to a lot of the tapes about business. He's very interested in art business, the business of art, making money. I mean, do you think that came from the aesthetic of your mother and father who worked hard, who were very aware that to make yourself in the world, you know, like your dad saying, I've saved this money for Andy's education, this idea that to make your way in the world, you needed money?
Andy was so honest that he used to say, when people would ask what's the mystery about him or what's so different, he says, there's nothing different about me or my art. He says, look at my art. He says, there's a Coke bottle, there's a can of soup. He says, you look at that and look at me. And he says, what am I hiding? The reason why I think he even told the truth that he's a businessman and selling his art, because when he was growing up, it was so hard to get money to, you know, we'd wear hand-me-down clothes. It's hard to get a dime to go to a movie. And you know, when you live that way, when you're growing up, it sort of sticks with you, because Vincent was the fellow that worked with him at the factory.
Vincent Fremont, yes.
And he told me, he says, the part that made me laugh is when they told me that he wouldn't leave the people that worked for him to throw anything away. He had to keep the coffee cans, you know. So
was your mother very thrifty? Did she instill in you that everything, you know, could be used to make something else? And the other thing I wanted to ask about your mother as well was, she took cans and made flowers from the cans.
I was just
going to
tell you that.
Yes.
She used to sell them for a quarter, and then the bigger ones were 35 cents. And she says, if it wasn't for the black people, she says, she probably someday didn't sell any. She went to the Hill District, and she says, the black people always bought the 35 cent ones. So, you know, a lot of these kids, whenever I speak to them down there, they probably think that there was always a TV or you go right to the bathroom. But if they knew, you know, how it was growing up, and I think I had a reflection on Andy's, you know, ways where he'd watch stuff.
Because apparently when he first got his tape recorder, there's evidence in the tape archive here that he first of all used it to tape things off the television so he could listen to them later. Because they didn't have a video, obviously, so he would tape the programs, like I suppose some kind of chat show programs, and I thought that was quite interesting.
Well, the reason why he didn't write stuff, because when you tape it, you have a record of it and it's faster, you know, so that's the reason why he did, I think, every on tape. And I'm surprised at how many tapes that he, you know, he has.
That's over 4,000 tapes.
Yeah, well.
But what he did, one thing that's quite interesting that he did, and I wonder whether you could shed any light on this, and that was, he would go to a dinner party and he would just put, like, the tape recorder down on the table. And you wonder why he did that. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it because in a way he was also collecting a slice of time, you know, almost like a proof that's different from a photograph, the people's voices. Yeah. There they were. And yet, what's interesting is the screen prints are very flat that he did of all these celebrities, and yet the voice is very rich. So you've got these two completely different kind of aesthetics, really.
Yeah. Well, then I guess in time, like 50 years from now, somebody want to say, geez, I wonder what the conversation Elizabeth Taylor was talking about. Well, here it is. It's right. Yeah. It's proof.
But he must have had an awareness, mustn't he, John, at that time, that he was preserving people's chatter. I mean, because chatter in itself, as it's being said, might not be that important or interesting, but suddenly, in, you know, 20 years time, when one finds a tape and it's Dennis Hopper and Liz Taylor or whatever, it suddenly becomes very interesting indeed to hear what they said on, you know, 3rd of Feb 1974, you know. So it's a very interesting archive. Did he collect as a child?
The only thing I can remember, like, I saved baseball cards, you know. I kept them for a while, then I gave them away. But a lot of people did. They kept them for a while, then I just gave him.
But you see, that's what's really interesting about Andy. In some way, he knew, he had an awareness, like with the time capsules, that somehow, at some point, these things would become a history, would be historic. Now, quite a lot's been written that was like an inoculation for Andy against death, that somehow if you keep everything, every voice recording, every mm-hmm. photograph, every yeah. little object. You're inoculating yourself against death because those things will live on after you.
Right, yeah, it's a history. He could foresee something like when I was up at his auction and they were auctioning some of his things. And here, like this watch, it wasn't even running. An auction offer like $2,500, and Fred Hughes was, he said, I was with Andy. He said he paid $10 for that, you know. So here, somebody's paying $2,500.
Another question, which I hope isn't painful to ask, but Andy didn't go to your mother's funeral. Why do you think that was?
Well, he couldn't stay in the house when my dad died. And he was laid out in the house. They were in the... He wouldn't sleep in that house, so I took him over
really?
To my aunt's place, yeah, for 3 days. You know, he
Why
stayed
do you
over.
Think that was, John? Do you think he just always had a terrible fear of
I didn't question him, but I figured he was a little kid, you know,
yeah.
and he was a yeah. really afraid of death.
Maybe and, because, it, was that after he had been ill?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he yeah. was scared of his own mortality and dying at that
right.
point,
he,
you know.
Yeah, he didn't want to go to the hospital or have a surgery because...
Yeah.
After he was shot, he used to tell us that he'll die before he has to go to hospital again. But, you know, a lot of people condemn him for not going to my mother's mm-hmm. funeral. And what I try to do is to cover up for him. And I said he was in Europe, but they don't understand the person's mm-hmm. feelings if they're not going through that. He didn't have that much money, but he paid for everything, you know, and it...
That's not mentioned, actually. So he actually yeah. paid for everything, but he didn't go.
Oh, yeah. I went up, and that's when he gave me a picture, a big painting of my mother.
Oh.
I think it was it's Quinn from, she wrote about Andy. She used to be a reporter for one of the magazines. She described Andy. She hit the nail on the head when she says, you know, Andy was a very generous person if he liked you. And if he didn't like you, he didn't give you anything, but he always had a reason, you know.
What did your mother, did you speak to your mother much about what she thought about what Andy was doing, particularly in the factory years, the early factory, the silver yeah. factory, when perhaps he was, you know, his life was much more decadent than after
yeah.
he was shot? I mean,
it's really true what she predicted. She says she don't know why Andy is working so hard, and she says he's going to leave everything and strange people are going to be fighting over his money. And here, if he only knew how much money the lawyers took for different lawsuits, you know.
There's a drawing show going to open on Saturday, and I believe, well, I've been told this and I've read it, that the script writing on many of Andy's drawings is your mother's.
Oh yeah, she did yeah. a lot of work, you know. And even when the signature, I told Vincent, I said, did you notice how the signature changed when my mother died? And he says, no. I said, well, you look, I says, you can see the handwriting where Andy...
But why did you get your mother to write on
he
the
He thought
pictures?
It was really nice.
He liked her
yeah,
writing better than his writing.
Yeah.
Because she has a very lyrical script, isn't
yeah.
she?
Like in the 60s, when we used to go up her, and then when my mother would, she'd play with the kids when they were small, then she said, I better get back to work or else Andy will fire me. You know, she's always making a joke out of it, and here she did a lot of his art for him, you know, helping him.
So I'm in the Victoria Mirror Gallery with Abigail Lane in her exhibition on the ground floor. The title of the exhibition is Tomorrow's World, Yesterday's Fever, in brackets, Mental Guests Incorporated. Abigail, we're on the ground floor and upstairs there are installation spaces and rooms with works, mostly projected videos. But down here there are panels, often painted, that are sort of slightly reminiscent of film posters as they used to be. But tell me about what you're showing here, because they actually refer to the works upstairs, don't they, in terms of their titles at least, well, and their imagery.
The posters which were made for each of the different films, Figment, The Inclination and Inspirita. And I had them as frame pictures in the last show, and then we made them, sent them small copies of that to Bollywood and had them painted as paintings for this one, which I wasn't sure what I was going to get because I've never made paintings, but I thought it would be good just in the prints of it to be quite sort of, they'd be kind of throwaway, not too, they're not really proper paintings in that way.
So they're sort of Bollywood film posters, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. They're made by Bollywood painters, yeah.
Okay. The relationship between these and the works upstairs is purely that they are posters for the films.
Yeah, totally. And also I wanted, because I can put text on them, I thought, you know, there are words said up in the films and stuff, but I wanted to be quite explicit in these, and I thought they're a bit more sort of kitsch in a way. And just introduce that kind of element of humour,
right,
which it's sort of obvious upstairs, but not so much. Like in the text in here, like he was the dark, her dark, and he wanted to play. Once you've actually written that down, it sort of, I hope, kind of reveals my sort of tongue-in-cheekness about things as much as anything else.
And they have an interesting kind of sort of tension or gap or relationship with the works, and they're film posters, but not posters about films in a strange sort of way.
No, not really. I mean, there's the things like brought to you from the depths of her unconscious, but in the way that normally a film poster would say, brought to you by Panavision or whatever it is. And again, I was just kind of sort of spoofing on that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a convention of Hollywood film posters, isn't
it?
And the works that we're going to look at and talk about, The Inspirator, which is a large space upstairs with the panda playing the bugle or the trumpet and various other elements in the room, which we'll see. The Inclination, which is the woman coming out of the water. I mean, this is just quick summaries. And The Figment, which is the principally the Elfine type character in orange that, that you presented or that you've made. So, shall we go upstairs then?
Okay.
We're in the Victoria Mirror Gallery. It's quite busy with a lot of people here. And well, should we go into the rooms one at a time? We'll just briefly introduce them, and then we can go downstairs and talk about them.
Okay,
so you lead me through.
We'll go into the Figment room first.
As we leave the Figment room, I should just say that you have the projected image of that orange sort of elfine male-like person, but also what appears to be a garden shed with wood chippings and a pair of shoes with mist coming from them.
Yeah, the smoking shoes.
Right. Where next?
Then we're going to go into the Inclination room. This is the order I prefer them to be, and I think people tend to do it this way around, but... No, obviously it's up to you. This one's more difficult because the soundtrack kind of needs to play out, which is 5 minutes long or something. Not that I'm saying we'll stay here for 5 minutes.
Describe what we're seeing, what we're looking at.
The double projection with the inclination of the woman crawling out of the sea. And as she comes out, crawls up the beach, and then she crosses from one screen into the other. But before she's left her first screen, she's coming up from the water again. I think this one relies a lot on the soundtrack, actually. Just it's quite monotonous, it's a very short loop. And it develops because of the sound rather than the fact that there's hours and hours of different footage. That soundtrack gets quite heroic after a while.
So again, we're moving in and out of rooms that have doors that close behind us.
Yeah, and we're about to go into the end room, which is the Inspirita, which is the relief. Because some people get really upset, especially in the first room, especially children.
So this is the projection of the panda figure in the forest playing the instrument and the mirror ball and the mirror ball fountain.
Yeah, and the fountain, the sound from the film, but there's also speakers built into the fountain so that that's much louder as well. I love walking down the corridor and just having all the light come straight at you.
So let's talk a little bit more, Abigail, about the figment. And the room itself, as you've just described, has a projection with this orange elfine figure. Now, there's a sense of fantasy, reality, but a narrative that can't quite be pinned down. But tell me about this particular part of it, this filmic element.
Well, I made that on its own to begin with. I'd made the shed and smoking shoes separately. Oh, actually, no, I hadn't made the shed. I'd just shown the smoking shoes on their own, so they weren't necessarily going to go together in the first place. So the film was really the beginning of all of this, and I wanted to make something that was like the figment of your imagination. And I think, although I like the room a lot, I think it relies a lot more on more sort of known imagery in a way, because he is red and he's slightly devilish and in a kind of more classic movie sort of way, whereas the other two seem to kind of progress in their own sort of worlds.
One of the things that interests me about the work is, you know, the idea of narrative, but it doesn't disclose what that narrative is, and it certainly doesn't seem to offer up any kind of sequential idea of a story being told.
No. I don't want to do that. I want to make some kind of atmosphere that you just go into and you get an English... You know, it doesn't matter that it's English or not English. I mean, some of the words are on the posters and stuff, so that makes it a bit clear. But I'm the dark, you're dark, I want to play, which is all kind of jokey in a way, but the way that he does it is, you know, it's punched in with high and low versions of it, so it's just completely abstract, really, when it's all put together. And I think it's more about a sensibility rather than actual narrative.
In one of the texts I've read about your work, Beckett was mentioned and referred to, and in the context of what's more poignant or potent is the unsaid, the space between words and the kinds of readings that can't be derived directly from what you're looking at. And I felt with this one, I just got an instinctive sense that there was a resonance of something going on.
Yeah.
To do with memory, to do with dreaming, but I couldn't pin it down.
Also, well, I had the idea that the figment of your imagination, I mean, it's kind of a crude way of splitting it up, but how I was thinking was very much as a sort of alter ego, something that I always saw the figment as your sort of caution and the alternative to whatever it is that you do, and the question inside your head that you always have, and whatever, you know, we all kind of sort of joke about having the good side and the bad side, and this.
Yes, sir. I mean, what about that dimension of the works, that of what's within fairy tales and within children's nursery rhymes, which are often not about what they're about, so to speak. There is a sort of a underlying...
Well, that's interesting you say, because there's, I mean, the whole thing of fairy tales and nursery rhyme stuff is they are supposed to sort of instill some sense of early morality for children. That's the idea behind them.
Tell me about the relationship then between the figment and the shed with the smoking shoes.
As I said, I made the smoking shoes quite separately for a particular space that I was left wondering what to do with, and this is what I decided to do. It's called You Know Who You Are, that piece on its own, which is actually a kind of personal reference to somebody in particular. But when the smoke comes out of the chute, obviously there's all that stuff with spontaneous human combustion and stuff, and I always kind of get pigeonholed into always trying to refer just to those oddities for the sake of it, and of course, and I am curious to all those sort of unexplained things, but I'm more curious about other people's curiosity in them and how people are always looking for something that isn't there, really, because you're expecting more and more.
And then we went into the space with the film The Inclination, which, as you were saying, is a female dressed in a white plastic suit coming out of the sea just before nightfall. Tell me about that piece.
Well, after I made the figment, in fact, I didn't. That was the. In fact, that was the last one I made. It wasn't the first one, but I already had both the other two in mind by then. And as I say, I thought that the figment, it got more complicated. Once I made that, I thought it wasn't enough just to say, well, this is your alter ego and this is something to show. I wanted to make things that refer to different, I don't know, I find it really hard to discuss it actually, but different ways that you go about life. So, you know, obviously he was, I am the dark, I am your dark, I want to play. I'm very tempting in that way. And then she's, the words for her is, I'm the light, I'll show you the way, trust me. Again, you know, kind of ridiculous in a way, but I wanted a kind of very steady progression, which is more to do with how you just go by your life year after year after year and the decisions that you make on a much more sort of rotary basis. And also because she's coming out of the sea, I felt that I wanted more sort of a larger thing. So it's not just about your own state of mind, but that whole Darwinian thing of emerging from the sea and going through life in a sort of steady way. And she's, you know, she's leading the, she has her headlamp on the front, on the top of her head, so she's kind of casting around and plodding her path through life.
You seem to draw on certain filmic nuances, and the Don't Look Now Red Dwarf sequence is one, and the other is perhaps to do with pantomime and to do with turn of the century tableaus of magic and mystery and theatrical imagery. Is that an area that is where your interest lies for some sort of inspiration or source material?
Magic in particular is something I always look at, and that's not witchcraft magic, but the whole history of magic and magicians and that kind of willing deception that takes place within magic, which I don't see as a lot different from art, really, the way that we're happy to be deceived by an image of something. So an image of a country scene or something, you're happy to go along with that. And I don't see that as completely different from really wanting the mystery involved in magic and knowing that you're being tricked, desperately wanting to have the solution and yet turning away at last minute if it's offered to you because you're actually happy to just go along with the kind of somebody else being in control a bit, really. Theatre and stuff isn't something I know anything about particularly, so my inspiration in that respect is, as you said, about magic, but I would look a lot at the posters and stuff for films, but also from you know, old sort of magic shows and stuff, which are just fantastic and I think completely inspirational. And circus was something that was introduced to me quite early on in my life because my mum was a huge circus fan and worked with the circus for a while and stuff like that.
And what about pantomime?
Pantomime's never played a big part in my life. I mean, and I hate musicals, which you'd be surprised, but you know, you'd be surprised about, really. So it's quite a specific interest. I think magic for me is a different thing. It's not just about a sort of showbiz thing, which I'm not such a, not so keen on. It's got this kind of really strange sort of other side to it, the whole magic circle secrecy thing and the seriousness of it in a way. And how you're not allowed to divulge different secrets and stuff. And
I'm interested that you brought up your sort of early exposure to circus. I mean, that's quite a significant reference when I think about the works.
It was it was a weird one. My mum was just completely passionate about it, and she'd get really excited about the idea. You know, the circus is coming to town, and she'd go up at dawn and kind of meet people and help them walk their tiger cubs and stuff. And she just had this. I don't know how else to express it other than a passion for it. And then when I was 15, she suddenly announced she was off, and she literally ran away with the circus. So she said she was going for 6 weeks. She stayed for about a year. She worked with them doing. I mean, she wasn't juggling or doing any of that stuff. But the whole point of the circus is you kind of mix in with all sorts of things. And it was, I think she just wanted to get on the inside of it a little bit. And we had so many funny, there were so many stories and strange intricacies to the way the whole thing works. And I think I've not adopted the same passion in the same way, because circus has changed so much. In those days, you know, there were animals involved, which, being a complete vegetarian, all that kind of stuff, I still maintain isn't necessarily a bad thing. And just when you would walk into the circus, I completely adopted her sense of enthusiasm for the smell of the sawdust. And this, I mean, it really is exciting. The circus comes to town, you put up the tent, all the stuff goes on inside of there, and then the whole thing folds up and disappears. And I suppose in many respects these shows are like that, because actually if you try and transport the show, it folds up into a van pretty much, because the projections, although they're so all encompassing in their size and in the rooms and sound and light and everything, of course they're just three little tapes, you know.
I'm here with Kenneth Noland at Vanna Jacobson Gallery. Kenneth, this is the first show you've had here for a number of years. One thing I noticed that Matthew Collins mentioned in relationship to your work was the word playful. And you mm-hmm. talk there about your work and the way you work through many of your ideas through a more almost playful aesthetic. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mentioned that play is very serious. It has parameters that are characteristic of the nature of play. Animals also abide by. There are certain kinds of rules that have to do with play, that in order to play, because it's another kind of reality, and it has accepted terms in order for it to be play. And play is also a practice, it's practicing. There is always a little margin allowed for little cheating. In every game, there's a little something that is a gray area for allowance for a little extra from the outside. Now, I wouldn't say that what I do is play. It's playful, possibly. It's not incidental play, and it's not superficial.
Throughout your career, you've worked abstractly in your paintings. You have dealt with shape and colour, and very much your work has been characterised by vibrant colours, very rigorous shapes, and also formulating a whole dialogue with the abstract, which has really been mm-hmm. your practice. I'm very interested in the way that you have developed this whole aesthetic to do with principles embedded in your work with shape.
All right. There was historical precedence. And most all traditional art proceeds from generation to generation, or might skip a generation or two before certain things are picked up again in terms of precedence. The kind of art that I make, abstract art, and not only had behind it the Impressionists, the Fauves, Cubist, the Abstract Expressionist, Mondrian, the Bauhaus influence. There were a lot of those sources that was a process of learning, right? Now, other artists chose other sources, like the pop artist, for instance, chose Duchamp, and they find a path there for what they do. What I do comes out of what I just said.
Now, you have also in your work used shaped canvases and sculptural forms. Could we follow that train of thought a little bit to discuss your canvases as objects?
Well, the materiality, since alluding to the to subject matter, say image making, you're left with stuff, I mean, with material, color, a canvas, say, and shapes. There's a big question about framing, and also the history of framing, and also of seeing a picture, which is defined by a rectangle, say. pages, books. So it has something to do with seeing. Now, artists traditionally, in all cultures, have used a minimum of raw material and of waste material, by and large, incidental things, stone, junk steel, and using the process of, say, of casting, using canvas and stretchers or boards, or and then of color, the color in caves. And that was before writing. Maybe writing came from painting or from drawing. I'm sure it did, you know, originally.
Still thinking historically, you did train at Black Mountain College, which
right.
has become legendary, of course. Can
yeah.
we talk a little bit about the influences, or maybe it wasn't the influences, or perhaps the teaching on your own practice, and whether some of the ideas, aesthetics and things are still with you from that time?
Well, at Black Mountain, we taught the Bauhaus method. So I learned a lot about color at Black Mountain, as well as design, matière studies, material studies of tactile qualities and so forth. You have to notice that in the tradition, artists of all sorts have been very close to the use of their eye and their hands. The musicians, or their ears and hand. That the hand, even in terms of writing, even though it's making script and writing and so forth, has a certain kind of touch, and has a touch of the mind through perceptions, the eye, the ear. And there's a kind of suspension, something that's not like gravity. When people look at paintings, as an example, their body gets affected kinetically, and they tip their heads, they stand back, they walk forward. What they're looking at looks like it's floating in a way. It floats away from, even though it's in a shape. That's also true in music, too. Your body reacts from your ear. So there's a feeling that's involved in that. And also, even in writing, when you're reading something that where you're really in contact, your eye doesn't see words anymore. It just sees the meaning. It's a flow. And it has kind of a suspension of concreteness. And it's in the nature of a little conversation, too, from the artist through the materials to a viewer, or someone who listens, or who also reads. There's this contact that's going on. It's an energy kind of exchange thing that art makes it possible to have.
Your works are contemplative. That was very much originally coming from what was then became known as the colour field painters,
right.
of which you were associated with or linked with in group shows.
Well, in the case of Morris, he was the first artist that I'd met in Washington that also liked Jackson Pollock. We also, at the very beginning, acknowledged liking Robert Motherwell. So we had a kind of a basis of something that we were seeing.
And the biomorphic forms.
Well, no, it was just the feeling.
Just the feeling.
Yeah, not
the
just
work.
The form, just
yeah.
The feeling. It was a sensing of something, too. We fell into a good kind of conversation. Neither one of us had arrived at a breakthrough. We were still working under influences and just stumbling and fumbling, not really satisfied of what we were doing. But we began to bring things to each other. I knew about where to get canvas that I'd found out from Helen Frankenthal, or he knew where he to get this new kind of paint, which was called Magna. And then I brought Morris to New York to meet Clement Greenberg. Clem took a liking to Morris, and during the kind of conversation and so forth, there was some kind of sensing that was going on that hadn't become executed yet. So the idea of the discussion was that we would break all the rules, try to ferret them out and get rid of them. Gradually, you know, they began to be just the materials, just the stuff. The colors and the different ways you can mix colors and the canvas, the nature of fabric. The canvas unstretched. And then finally, the stretching of canvas in ways that accommodated the materiality of the stuff. That's the way we got started.
How important was the relationship of Helen Frankenthaler to the group when you were talking about forming ideas, thinking about through ideas, and being very excited by finding a new language to express what you were trying to solve? Was she a very important figure in that equation?
You bet. You bet she was, because she had found a way of using Pollock, particularly, as materials. And then using the canvas as canvas first, and then building a stretcher, putting it on, stretcher, etc. She was the first to come after that found this way. And I think then we came in. The abstract expressionists were using another kind of looseness, but it had to do with figures. De Kooning always really painted figures. The loose brush and action painting kind of stuff was going on over there, but it was in an illusion kind of category of depiction. Yeah. Without the depiction and without symbols and without it having any reference to anything other than the experience of experiencing it as something, it was quite different than everything that was going on. It was very liberating. They call it breakthrough. You know, it's been called that. Having a breakthrough.
The show is called Kenneth Noland New Paintings. They look totally fresh. Now, of course, they look familiar as well, mm-hmm. because we're familiar with the stylistic modes of your work. Can we talk about this drive that you have to continue to create these works in this style? I mean, they are, well,
even though they're circles, like the earlier ones, they have been informed by, obviously, things that have gone on since. Even starting at Black Mountain and a little afterwards, I had a tendency to center. So all along, I doodle sometimes, and I doodle circles. I mean, and paint. Even had posters made that I could paint on as circles. I guess it had something to do with that floating quality. The horizontal stripe pictures, because they float. The chevrons flow, and it has something to do with it, the symmetry and the centering. So there's something about the centering that keeps me focused on it.
Do you create the works differently, physically create them differently from how you did when you were first doing your centered or concentric works?
Yeah, actually, there's a certain kind of refinement that's gone on. And that is, before all of the first circles were painted on the floor on unstretched canvas and then stretched. These new series of paintings are painted on a square canvas, stretched. The sizes are fairly arbitrary. I like a 5-foot size, and I like a 4-foot size, of which these paintings and this exhibition are.
Is that, again, to do with the way that the body relates to that kind of size of work?
I do this very arbitrarily. I like to get the proportions. It makes a physical difference to somebody relating to it. The color now, there's a lot of good colors out there now, and materials. I can use different processes. I can spray, can use rollers, I can paint by hand. So I can do all of those things in order to get the different kind of tactile qualities I want.
Do you find that certain colours you're drawn to, hand painting certain colours or spraying certain colours? Do you find that happens?
The ground comes first, red, ochre, blue, something. And then I draw circles, pencil, from the center. Then I spray around the edges and get it to float. That's a very simple method. There's no secrets here. And then I hand paint from the center out. So it's gives a kind of painting towards the center and painting out of the center. It's a kind of a pulse, right?